Ready.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Philip Wagner. In this case, the Court below refused to, in the terms of its holding, reward the appellant for his efforts in defense of his earlier application for attorney fees and expenses under the Equal Access to Justice Act. We believe that that holding relies upon a clear misinterpretation of that statute. The statute requires that the appellant be, or the prevailing party, be provided reasonable fees for all parts of the civil litigation. The defense of his EJIA application is a part of that process. This court has held in Fritz that the defense, or excuse me, the inquiry into a fee agreement under the court's authority under 7266 comes within the civil action parameters of a consideration of EJIA or entitlement to EJIA before the reviewing court.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the same hold true here when we're dealing with the defense of the reasonableness of a fee. Mm-hmm. The government did not contest prevailing party. The government did not assert that it was substantially justified. The government simply attacked the reasonableness of the fee sought, and Judge Lance reduced the fees by approximately 26% and affirmed or awarded fees in the amount of approximately 76%. Therefore, Mr. Wagner should have been entitled to the reasonable expenditure of attorney fees and time. The attorney that submitted that fee application proactively determined that the that there should be a proportional reduction and essentially asked for a fee for approximately half of the time in which was actually spent in the defense of the EJIA application.
What do you think is the right way to approach the calculation of the fee on fee in a situation in which, as in this case, there is a portion of the fee application that's uncontested, and then B, a portion that's contested, some of which is cut back? Should the, in thinking about the arithmetic here, should you have a fee on fee that is calibrated according to the entire amount that was requested minus the amount that was granted, or focusing only on the amount that was contested, take the fee on fee based on the reduction in that smaller amount?
I would suggest that it is through the lens of the Fritz decision that it is part of the civil action.
Yeah.
And therefore, as part of that civil action, regardless of how the reviewing court decides the appropriateness of the original application, there are some portions of that that were required to be defended as a result of the government's objection.
Yeah.
Now,
suppose that in the fee application that the government did not contest 75% of it and contested 25% of it, and the government is entirely successful with respect to the 25% that it challenges. Under those circumstances, why should there be a fee for the fee litigation?
If the government were to have conceded that 75% number, then I think in your hypothetical, Your Honor, that would probably be correct, because there would have been no fee awarded, maybe not. I'm sorry. As I got finished with that sentence, I just realized that that doesn't work, because what you're required to do is to defend the application. And I'm not really sure in the Solomon-esque notion of dividing the baby that we can really subdivide the defense.
Because I suppose you don't really know whether the government's going to oppose the application until you put in the work to prepare the application, right? In other words, you have to assemble all the hours, and you have to put the justification, and you have to send it to the government, and that's a considerable expense. And then the government says, you're right as to 75%, we oppose as to 25%. And even if you say, okay, and you fold your tent at that point, you would argue, I would assume, that you're entitled to some fee on fee based on the fact that you had to go through the work of preparing the application.
Well, not only preparing the application, preparing a response to the government's assertion. The mere fact that the government asserts it.
Right, but even if your response to the government's assertion is, yeah, you're right, and we withdraw the extra 25%, you would still say, I would assume, that you're entitled to something for the time you put in preparing the application.
For preparing the application, no question, Your Honor. But if it ends
up
in a...
Is that part of what's being claimed here?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
That's a problem. Is that?
I agree.
Yeah.
Because what we're looking at is precisely the circumstance that you're suggesting without quite the precision of a concession. But the fact is that Mr. Wagner was required to respond to the challenge to the fee application.
So what he's claiming here is the cost of responding to the government.
Absolutely.
And that's all he's claiming.
Yes. And he's not claiming any fees in defense of that portion of his fee application, which was reduced by the court. He acknowledges that in that portion, he should not be entitled to a fee.
And he's not claiming the cost of preparing the fee application.
No, he's not. Well, he did in his original application.
But the fee on fee application, it gets confusing because there are two applications. The original fee application, then there's the fee on fee application.
Well, I'm not sure there's a fee on fee application. Well, there is a preparation of an application for that fee. And in fact, if you'll notice in the appendix, he didn't charge at all for that.
For the second.
You know, he said, you know, in the exercise of billing judgment, I'm not going to bill for that.
Okay.
But there was time that was spent in responding to the government's contest.
And that he does bill for.
And I believe the statute requires it under its plain term.
And that was the portion as to which he got, what was it, about 30%?
No, he got nothing.
The portion of, I mean, the government said, with respect to the original fee application,
yes,
the government opposed a chunk of that, and the court awarded about 30% of the opposed chunk. Am I right about that, roughly?
Well, it was my understanding.
It was a portion, less than half, I think.
It was my understanding from reading the record that the entire application prevailed at approximately 70%,
right,
and 30% of the original application was reduced.
Okay, but my understanding was that there was a chunk of the original application that was not opposed. There was another chunk that was opposed, and of that second chunk, he got some but less than half of the amount that was in dispute.
You got 32% of the amount in dispute, I think.
I believe that's correct.
Okay. Right.
I mean, I believe that's a correct characterization.
All right. And he, and on in his, well, go ahead. I'm with you. I hear you.
Well, honestly, Your Honors, I believe that that's the substance of the argument in the case. I don't believe that there's anything else that I can add in any comments further. Unless there are any further questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Rabinowitz.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This court should dismiss appellant's claim because the Veterans Court applied the correct legal standard in denying appellant his EJA fees on fees request. And all appellant is...
That sort of seems like a difficult argument that they applied the correct legal standard. I mean, the Gene and in our cases, I mean, you're entitled to fees for fees. And the court sort of said, well, because the amount you're claiming in fees now is more than the amount that the original fee application was reduced by, you don't get anything. That can't be correct, can it?
Well, what the court actually did, if we look at the underlying EJA application, and specifically if you look at the challenged amount and what the court found with regard to those challenged amounts, with regard to each of the challenged amounts, the court found that appellant's position was unreasonable. So now when in then discussing...
Yeah, but the question is, why did it say it was unreasonable? Because it exceeded the amount that was lopped off the original request. That's got to be wrong, right?
Right. So I'm actually backing up, Your Honor. In other words, if we go back to the original EJA decision, which is the decision of that that he wants his fees for fees on, the court in that case held that each of the challenged amounts by the secretary, appellant's amounts were unreasonable.
Well, that's always what a court will say when a court is reducing a fee application from X amount to X minus N. But I mean, that happens in many, many fee application cases. You're not suggesting that because of the unreasonable conduct of the fee applicant, that the fee applicant in cases in which there's any reduction should get no award on fees on fees, are you?
No, that would obviously be a very extreme position, and that is not what we're advancing here.
So what exactly is the situation in which there should be no fee-on-fee award,
instead,
in your view?
If it appears here that what has occurred, because the main of what was challenged was held to be unreasonable, therefore the court, in deciding the EJF fees on fees, refused to award reasonable fees for what in the main was unreasonable. Because again, the secretary only challenged.
But so if it's over, if there's a challenged amount, let's suppose it's a $10,000 fee application, mm-hmm. the secretary challenges $2,000, and the court grants $900 of the $2,000 that was challenged, then there should be no fee on fee award?
I think what the court would have to do in that case is look at the underlying litigation that gave rise to the fees on fees, and make a determination as to whether or not on the whole, whether or not that position was reasonable or unreasonable. Just taking the numbers in the abstract it's difficult to come up with any single answer. And I would presume that it would seriously constrain the reviewing court to say, you know, that it was $900. Maybe, for example, in your Honor's hypothetical, so out of $10,000, $2,000 is challenged. Now, the award of $900, though, was because of the $2,000, the secretary's position was completely, in other words, the arguments the court completely rejects, and what instead, it was reduced to the $900 amount because $1,100 really related to clerical tasks as opposed to something that was uncollectible, for example, under EJF. So in that particular case, yes, it would the appellant should, in that case, fees for fees should be awarded because the underlying litigation was reasonable. But that is not what has occurred here. Instead, of the challenged amounts, the court held that appellant wasn't entitled to those because it was unreasonable. And it said so.
It wasn't entitled to all of them.
It was entitled to
some of it, which was because it was reasonable. Well, 30% is...
30%, but again, there were actually three categories.
In baseball, 30% is very good.
Yes, the 300 average is excellent.
So what...
But if you look at it, so there were three categories of fees that were challenged by the secretary, one of which the secretary was completely successful on. It was the 8.8 hours was denied in its entirety. Of the 14 hours, that was reduced to 6 hours. That's again, it's a 60% reduction. And then with regard to the final 3 hours, it was reduced by half. So if you look at that, and presumably the court when it reviewed the fee for fee application, in looking closely at what had been awarded and what appellant had been successful or more specifically unsuccessful on, the court made the determination that on the main it was unreasonable. Now, why, you know, how one breaks that out in other cases?
Unreasonable because of what?
It was unreasonable with regard to which of the fees.
It was your argument, I take it, is it was unreasonably large request.
Yes. All right. Yes.
So you can deny fees for fees entirely if the original fee application was unreasonably large?
No.
No, I wouldn't think so.
No. And again, this isn't asserting a per se rule, and the court never asserted a per se rule that, you know, if there's a certain percentage reduction, then each of fees for fees aren't awarded. Instead, what the court apparently did was it looked at the challenged amounts, and of those challenged amounts, because the majority of the challenged amounts appellant was unsuccessful on, therefore the court held it wasn't going to throw good money after bad. That because that litigation, in other words, the underlying litigation, was held to be...
Wait a second. Suppose there are three contested amounts. Let's label them A, B, and C, and the government succeeds as to A and B, but it's unsuccessful as to C. Why shouldn't the applicant, why shouldn't the veteran get some compensation for successfully litigating the C category?
I think in that instance that the applicant would be entitled to, because again, in with regard to that portion, they were successful on, and that litigation, it's reasonable for them to be awarded attorney's fees. But looking at what occurred below here, that isn't what occurred. And instead, what the court found was is that they that the appellant's litigation position, that they were wrong, that appellant was wrong in requesting those additional fees.
The court would have found the appellant was wrong on both A and B in Judge Dyke's hypothetical.
Yes.
Why wouldn't that be the same? I'm not sure I'm understanding the distinction between Judge Dyke's hypothetical and this case, where the court found that the appellant had charged too much time for particular activities, but nonetheless seems to have found that those activities, or at least some of them, were legitimate activities for which fees were properly allocated.
But in our case, what the court has found is that the majority of what had been claimed for A, B, and C, if we use the same, was unreasonable.
Well, so, if that's the same as in Judge Dyke's hypothetical.
Well, in Judge Dyke's hypothetical, C was completely reasonable. So that is, in other words, the distinction
so
is...
If A, B, and C are 3 days of working on a motion, and the court says you should have done the motion in 1 day, you don't get fees. But if they were three different motions and the court said two of those motions were unnecessary, then you do get fees?
No, I
is that
I,
your position?
No, not at all, Your Honor. And this is...
I'm having a hard time
this
finding
is exactly
out, figuring
what
out
the...
why my question wasn't a fair statement of the relation between your... position, as I understood it, in Judge Dyke's hypothetical.
Because I think that this confusion actually supports the notion that there has to be some discretion in each of for the court to look at the underlying litigation and to look at the success rate, as the Supreme Court has said, that and then to take it all and decide how much was challenged, what exactly was done here, and what was reasonable and what was unreasonable, and in so doing. The court should have the discretion to say if it, in their opinion, this was an unreasonable, just looking at the challenged amount, that would be sufficient to deny all EJA fees. Obviously, there are closer cases where, if, for example, in Judge Dyke's hypothetical, if A was only worth $100 and B was worth $100, but the C portion was worth $10,000, then being successful on C is a lot more important than being successful on A or B. So having that discretion and being able to look at the underlying case, which the Veterans Court did in this instance, and making the determination that this, in looking at what the court held with regard to the underlying EJA application and with regard to the underlying EJA litigation, that was unreasonable. And it is going to be difficult to offer any sort of per se rule, A, B, C, one out of three, or any sort of percentage, because one could easily envision a scenario, for example, where the majority of time, the majority of EJA time was spent on A in Judge Dyke's hypothetical. So if the majority of EJA time was spent on A, then if you're not successful on A, it seems absurd to then say that I can collect all the money that if the EJA fees that we're discussing, to use a hypothetical, are $10,000 in total, of which $7,000 goes to A, and then $2,000 goes to B, and then $1,000 worth of time goes to C. So because you're successful on C, that shouldn't entitle you to the $7,000 spent on A.
They're not claiming
that.
They're not asking for the amount spent on unsuccessful efforts.
Well, first of all, it's important to note that the amount that's been reduced here is not the amount of the challenged amount. In other words, instead, the proportion.
Yeah, I understand. You could make an argument that it's the wrong focus.
Yes.
That it should be on the challenged amount, and that they were only successful on 32% of that. Therefore, they should only get 32% of the fee as opposed to 70%. I understand that.
Yes.
The question is, do they get nothing?
Do they get nothing? So this is obviously an extreme example where the court has held that they're entitled to nothing. But the rationale and the legal standard that was applied was the correct one. And then making the
determination. Do you have any authority in, I mean, fee applications are found
everywhere.
They're universal.
Yes.
And the other circuits have many of these cases, in many of which, as far as I could ascertain, the approach is that if you're partially successful, then you get a partial fee on fee. That's a fairly typical. Do you have any case in which there's been an altogether denial of the fees on fees award in a situation where the underlying fee application was partially successful?
I have found none, Your Honor.
Neither did I.
Okay. But at the same time, the the rule that the court applied, and I realize that that awarding nothing is an extreme case, but at the same time, what the court did, what all the court was doing was looking at what had occurred below and made the determination that on the whole, in this particular case, and there are and the Veterans Court in reviewing fee applications has in certain instances in partial success has awarded proportional fees. But in this case, was an
extreme... Well, doesn't Gene really say that that's what should happen in footnote 10? Well, I mean, isn't it pretty clear where it says fee-for-fee litigation should be excluded to the extent that the applicant ultimately fails to prevail in such litigation? Seems to suggest that to the extent that the applicant does prevail, they get fees, right?
To a degree, although the example that's offered in Gene is also somewhat interesting in that it says if the government's challenge to a requested rate for paralegal time resulted in the court's recalculating and reducing the award for paralegal time from the requested amount, then the applicant should not receive fees for the time spent defending the higher rate. So that presumably means that you can't, even if the rate is just a reduction, there may be instances where the defendant should not receive fees for the time spent defending that rate because that reduction is so significant. So if, for example, the reduction would be 99%, so there should be, maybe there, in other words, what the court did here was it said it was such a significant reduction, it was so significant that this was so unreasonable that therefore there's a denial of fee. I mean, while it isn't de minimis, it's a 30, you know, ultimately there was a 30%, but the court held that that was insufficient to rise to the level that now that there'd be reasonable fees.
Now you spent, your brief was directed to the fact that your position was that we have no jurisdiction over this case. Are you in response to the arguments this morning, are you standing on that position?
As well,
or
that there...
Do we have the ability to review this?
Well, to the extent that the court is going to review whether or not in fact, this was reasonable or unreasonable, that is, the application of law to fact, then there would be no jurisdiction. Obviously, to the extent that it's just the interpretation of the EJIA statute, this court then of course, has jurisdiction. And depending on the court's view of that, that is where the divide is between whether or not there would or would not be jurisdiction here. So to the extent that appellant is seeking to relitigate the whether or not he was reasonable or unreasonable, which is the application of law to fact, so then indeed there would be no jurisdiction. To the extent that the court would find, and we don't, and our position is that this is not the case, that there was a reinterpretation of the statute, so then this court, of course, would have jurisdiction in that scenario. And if there's no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Benowitz. Mr. Carpenter, if you have any rebuttal.
Briefly, Your Honor, the position of the government in defense of the decision below essentially seeks to do precisely what Gene asked that we not do, and that's create a second litigation. If you adopt the position, the interpretation that was relied upon by the Veterans Court, then the government is encouraged to attack EJIA application so that they can get a single finding of unreasonableness on any portion of that application. If they do, then under this rule, and this interpretation, fees on fees are negated. And that's simply not a correct interpretation of either the statute or the Supreme Court's decision in Gene. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Mr. Rabinowitz.